Let me guess, you saw that work on Inspector Gadget. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast that never turns down a game of penny poker. Joey Travolta, Frank Stallone, Don Swayze, anyone with the surname Baldwin, not called Alec. There's a long list of brothers who've been able to enjoy acting careers in the slipstream of their better-known, more successful sibling. Most of the time, they get a brief moment of fame before the novelty of their name and the paucity of their talent wears out its welcome with audiences. But, against the odds, there is one man who emerged from the shadow of his older brother to have a surprisingly enduring 40-year career. So much so that, despite various career ups and downs, he has become, for better or worse, a fixture of the entertainment landscape. Who is that man, you impatiently ask? Well, it's Jim Belushi. So on this show, we're looking at 1994's Royce, a somewhat bizarre attempt to recast Belushi Jr. as a James Bond-style action hero. To help me review the film, I'm joined by my better-talented brother by another mother. It's the DTV connoisseur himself, Matt Poirier. Welcome back, Matt.
Thank you, and thank you for that kind introduction. I can't say that I'm better talented. I
Modesty forbids.
Yes, no, for sure. This show it was one of my favorite podcasts, and I think you do a great job with all this stuff.
Oh, the fiver is in the post for your kind words. But this is your third appearance on it on Exploding Helicopter, so that makes you a three-peater. And I know as anyone who is familiar with your site on your site DTV Connoisseur, you love putting having actors in various clubs. So you're now in the three club.
Yes, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because I think Jim Belushi might be in the one club on my site, but I'm excited. I'm honored to be a part of the three club.
Well, I know you've just inducted Dolph Lundgren into the 60 club because he's now the subject of 60 reviews on your site. So you've got a little way to go before you to catch up with the big Swede.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Dolph and then Gary Daniels, a fellow Brit, is actually, he's second with 50-something reviews. People don't usually expect to hear, they expect Dolph, but then when they hear that Daniels is second, that's usually a surprise for people.
Well, now I've got you on here, Matt, because I wanted you to try and help me understand Jim Belushi, because, you know, occasionally my mind wanders to Mr. James Belushi, and I see him in a film, or I see his name mentioned somewhere, and I kind of don't quite understand how he has managed to sort of have a 40-year career in films and televisions. And he's a sort of a bit of a strange guy to be puzzled by. But now that you're here, I mean, you know, how do you think, you know, what sort of place does Jim Belushi sort of occupy in the American entertainment landscape? And how do you explain his appeal?
Well, it's interesting because I think we're looking at Royce here, and I think there's almost like a pre and post according to Jim, you know, the sitcom he did, Jim Belushi. So that this 90s Jim Belushi that we're going to look at, it was like he was kind of like you said, he was, you know, he had the name for his brother, and it feels like he just did a lot of movies like this where it was like the movie was either like a ripoff or like a take on something else. You know, it's like K-9 instead of Turner and Hooch, or there's the one that he did with Grodin that I can never remember the name of. It's like a Trading Places type movie. You know, a lot of that kind of stuff. But also in the 90s, he did, I mean, he could do whatever you needed him to do. Like, okay, your independent noir film, you need the noirish, you know, kind of patsy flop lead guy who's seduced by whoever, Linda Fiorentino or Gina Gershon. Sure, we'll have Jim Belushi do that part, and we'll get it released, you know, on limited theater release. And then I guess, you know, when the movie industry kind of starts to shift in the late 90s after Titanic to kind of more big tent projects, it's kind of like, okay, well, we're only going to release so many movies. We don't really have a place for Belushi. And he gets on the According to Jim show in 2001. And I think at that time, you know, the King of Queens show was popular in America. And every, you know, that's kind of how things work. And, you know, it's like if something's good, everybody wants to make their own version of it. And that's, you know, of course, Belushi's the guy when you're making another version of something. and so they were making their own version of King of Queens. And one of the things we always talk about in the U.S. is there's sort of a different set of tastes between the coasts and then the middle of the country, or what we derisively refer to as flyover country. And so King of Queens had a very Gen X edge to it, and a very New York City edge to it. And I think especially after 9/11, when things were being produced at that time, there was a sense of wanting to bring sort of Americana back in a way. And so Belushi was like, his show was like a version of King of Queens that was only like, it was like softer. He was more boom, you know, he was a boomer. It was more of a kind of a traditional family. And, you know, that's kind of the Belushi we know now, this sort of oafish, you know, doughy, goofy dad that, you know, that, like, now, of course, there's, like, a reckoning with this kind of dad on TV shows. It's like, what do we do with the doughy, oafish white male lead? And, you know, there's a show, Kevin Can F Himself, where they're trying to figure out what to do with him, or, you know, other shows like that, The Chair with Sandra Oh, where, you know, and at that time, it just seemed like it was like, okay, yes, of course, there's this goofy, oafish guy who's the center of everything, and all around him are all these, you know, his children are great and smart, his wife is smart and pretty, and they're just sort of, mitigating this oafish, goofy guy. And I think that's where Belushi is now, I think. And again, like, as America, we're reckoning with this kind of guy that, like, it seems like all the popular shows now don't know what to do with the doughy, oafish, goofy white male character. And that's where Belushi is. But he's, like you said, he's eked out quite a career. And I think the older me now respects the fact that he has made a successful career as an actor, you know? Like, not everybody can do that.
Well, exactly. And, you know, if you go through his CV, I mean, there's plenty of dreck in the Belushi CV. But if you go through it, he's worked with Roman Polanski, David Lynch, Oliver Stone, Michael Mann. I mean, he's worked with some really big names in filmmaking that, you know, anyone would, you know, most actors would, you know, kill to have some of the associations that he has had with filmmakers.
Yeah, I mean, the one that really sticks out for me is when he did Gang Related, and I think in 1997, it was like the last film, I think, that Tupac Shakur shot. Mm. And, you know, at that time, everybody was looking at Tupac Shakur as like, wow, this guy can really act. It's not just like a novelty to have him as a rapper acting the film, but there's a sense that like, oh, this guy could maybe someday get the kind of dramatic role that maybe he even gets an Oscar. Like, people were really excited to see what he was going to do. And when I think of Jim Belushi being in Gang Related, it did not seem odd at that time in the late 90s that Jim Belushi would be the sort of veteran actor that would prop up Tupac or allow Tupac to, you know, kind of, you know, blah or flourish in that film and be like another stepping stone in his career. And now the idea of Jim Belushi playing a role like that, like in that Gang Related, we wouldn't even consider it. Like, if there was another, you know, maybe 50 Cent or, you know, another, you know, whoever today that's trying to transition and make a serious acting career, you know, if you put him with Jim Belushi, it wouldn't look the same as it did back then.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting you mentioned Gang Related because, you know, I don't know what you think of that film, but I'd be interested to know. Personally, I think that is a terrific film. You know, there are a lot of great 90s neo-noirs. You've mentioned, I think you mentioned The Last Seduction earlier. That's one of them. Things like Red Rock West. And I think Gang Related is absolutely in that territory. And I think it's a terrific film that probably doesn't quite get, you know, talked about enough in, you know, when people are talking about that revival of neo-noir that we saw in the 90s. I don't know if you are a similar fan of that movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel the same way. And I think I had to kind of bring my brain back to that time period in the late 90s because it was in that mindset was, oh, what is Tupac going to? Or now, you know, at that point, I think when it was released, he'd already been killed. So there was a sense of like, oh, you know, kind of almost like melancholy, like watching the film. And when you mentioned doing this show and I was going through his Belushi's CV, I was like, no, you know, Belushi's good in Gang Related. And again, it didn't seem like it was like you said, it feels like another one of those. I think you're right. I think it kind of gets lost in the 90s neo-noir because there were so many really great ones. And also that one was kind of like the later end of the period. And I think post Titanic, I think a lot of movies got kind of lost there in that period. Maybe that was what – I don't remember. But I know that like – I didn't think of it as a Belushi film, but I also didn't think it was odd that Belushi was in it. I completely forgot that he was in it, and I just have this idea of the post-sitcom Jim Belushi and forgetting that, no, he was a part of why that film was good.
Okay, I think it's time we got stuck into Royce. So there's no trailer for this film, so let's have a listen to a short clip instead.
You brought all of us to the end of the world to hijack a train loaded with nuclear warheads?
Yeah. And to collect $60 million. I'm sorry, did I forget to tell you that part? $60 million after expenses. That's $7 million to each of us boys.
Come on, that's folding cash. It takes a ball player 2 years to make that kind of money.
That line's going to be crawling with troops, Groovy. It's an impossible gambit.
It's not impossible, Alec. Don't say it's impossible. Don't sell us short. We speak the language and we know this country inside and out. This operation is no more problematic than any of the others we pulled off in the last 6 years. All it takes is planning, commitment, and execution, all right?
You mind saying who's gonna give us $60 million?
A Southeast Asian drug cartel. And no, I don't mind saying.
Ruby, so you really want to hand over nuclear bombs to these creeps?
What's the difference? That technology is for sale to anybody who wants it.
And, as an extra added bonus, General Nikolai Romanov of the KGB has agreed to help us pave the way for this operation.
Romanov? What are you talking about?
Oh, wait a minute. Romanov made rank on the corpses of this unit. Now, we're supposed to put our lives in his stinking hands?
Correction. His greedy stinking hands. Russia's a whole new world, boys. Here's the best part. You ready? Senator Scanlon has graciously provided us with the exact route and schedule for the train. Now, until then, there are a few amusing little tasks that need to be performed. But, guys, listen to me. I swear to God, we can do this.
After liberating hostages from Bosnia, secret agent Shane Royce is told that the end of the Cold War has made his covert ops team redundant. Gribben, a fellow spy angry over the prospect of unemployment, recruits his old partners to steal some nuclear warheads and sell them to a drug cartel. But when Royce refuses to join the conspiracy, he finds himself framed for murder. In order to clear his name, Royce goes after Gribben and his former comrades in order to stop their nuke theft and rescue the son of the senator that they're also holding hostage. Heading up the cast, we have Jim Belushi as Royce. Alongside him, we have the wonderfully droll Miguel Ferrer, a veteran character actor Peter Boyle, Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Gold Blend enthusiast Anthony Head, Chelsea Field, aka Teela from Masters of the Universe, and Ralph Ineson, aka Finchy from The Office. We should point out that Royce was in fact a made-for-TV movie and was directed by TV veteran Rod Holcomb, who's worked on everything from the original 70s Battlestar Galactica through to The Good Wife in more recent years. There are a couple of other interesting names behind the camera. The director of photography on this was Thomas Del Ruth, who worked on Stand By Me, The Breakfast Club and The Running Man. He also shot over 100 episodes of The West Wing, so look out for a lengthy walking and talking shots in this. Should also mention the composer for this, Stanley Clarke, who, if you're a jazz fan, you'll know him from his work in the pioneering jazz fusion group Return to Forever. Otherwise, you might know him from his film scores for stuff like Passenger 57 or Boys in the Hood. This film has a user rating of exactly 5 on IMDb and a 2.7 out of 5 user rating on Letterboxd. So with all of that out of the way, Matt, what did you make of Royce?
So I think this is a movie where nostalgia maybe makes me a little softer on it because, you know, the 90s part of it, it's very evident and I can feel that in there. And I think there was a part of me that just liked a lot of that element of it that made me maybe forgive aspects of the plot, the exposition. There's also a really nice cast in here that I think, you know, I'm a big fan of Miguel Ferrer, a big fan of Anthony Head, and Michael Halsey has a very small piece in it, but he's a, you know, Albert Pyun mainstay that I always enjoy seeing in different things. And so that part of it, I think, mitigated it some, but I mean, it's one of those plots where it's like, things just kind of take a long time, and then suddenly it's like, oh, we've only got 15 minutes left, and it's like, you got to put on your goggle, your eye goggles or your eye protection because all the loose ends are flying together so quickly. And so it had a bit of that as well.
Yeah, I was very excited about doing this film, and I thought, oh, I've got to get Matt on to do this. And I think having watched it again for this podcast, it's definitely gone down a notch in my estimations. I think the first time I saw it, I was, you know, I knew it had an exploding helicopter in, so you know, it had Jim Belushi in the main role, so you know, obviously I set my expectations accordingly. And so this film, I think I was very pleasantly surprised by it because it just exceeded my expectations in a lot of ways. And but I think on this second viewing, you know, they've probably my rating of it has probably settled to something that's a little bit more realistic. I mean, I think overall it's a pretty entertaining watch. I mean, when you know, if I'd watched this back in the 90s, I would have happily lapped it up as a nice piece of you know, as a good piece of entertainment. I think now, being a bit older, a bit wiser, with a lot more films under my belt, I can see some of the issues and flaws. And yeah, as you pointed out, I think there's a bit of issue with the pacing of this film a little bit, and there's a few sort of twists and turns in the plot that just feel like they're unnecessarily complicated and not really adding a great deal to proceedings. But you know, kind of overall, I really enjoyed it, and I thought Jim Belushi worked for the most part in this film. And I think he is actually one of the reasons why I think I enjoyed this film. And I think the other aspect being that I really enjoyed being a big James Bond fan was that I enjoyed the fact that this film is playing with the 007 persona and sort of making a lot of fun with it throughout the film. So I think for those reasons, I kind of overall, I enjoyed Royce, not as much as I did on my first viewing, but still, you know, I had a good time with this film.
Yeah, I can actually say, cause, you know, I saw it just the one time for us to discuss it, and I can kind of see how it doesn't really have a repeat viewing ability. To, you know, it doesn't have that kind of feel. I mean, because I agree with you on the overall sense that, like, this is not, you know, it has its flaws, but it is kind of just a fun, you know, I think it's like it clocks in like an hour and a half or so, and it's a fun time killer that I think, especially with when you throw in the fact that it was made in the 90s, and you can kind of get some kind of fun out of that part of it as well. That yeah, there's a lot worse you could do with 90 minutes for sure.
Now, I wouldn't say this film is an action comedy, but it does have very clear comedic bent to it. We have Belushi in the main role here, and he's playing very much a Belushi style character, so someone who makes a lot of, you know, sarcastic asides, and you know, the humor here is very clearly sort of slanted towards subverting the James Bond you know, persona. I mean, how did that, you know, I've already put my cards on the table. I said I really sort of enjoyed the fun it sort of pokes at that omniscient sort of, you know, spy who, you know, is able to get himself out of every situation. He can talk a woman into bed with, you know, just with, you know, whenever he pleases, and you know, this film kind of pokes a lot of fun at that. You know, how did that work for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think in particular the fact that he had trouble with, you know, that he was trying to seduce women and he was falling on his face. I thought that part of it in particular was really good. That it's like, you know, the movie starts where he's at this nice resort, and actually the woman is actually from the UK, so he's like, you know, oh, you're English, oh, da 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 da, you know, and of course. And he's like trying to hit on her, and it doesn't work, you know. And you know, we realize it's a plot point where his card's not working, and he's being called in to do another job. But I like that. And then, you know, there's a few other moments in the film like that where he's hitting on somebody, and he's like really kind of putting the moves on her, and she's just like, nope, I'm not interested. Because you know, right, with James Bond, it was always like, you know, whoever the Bond girl was, you know, that he would that was, you know, and of course, I mean, part of that is that, you know, when you're comparing Sean Connery or even you know, Timothy Dalton to James Belushi, you know, you're definitely a different drop in quality. I mean, I'm sure maybe there's someone that find the Chicago accent endearing, but beyond that, I don't know.
Yes, and I think that's why, you know, Belushi in this film works, and I think that's why I can kind of get along with him in this film, because the film is poking fun at his character, and he is not successful with women. Because I actually recently rewatched, you know, Red Heat, where I think in many ways Belushi is playing a similar sort of fast-talking, wisecracking character, but in that film, he's the star of the show. He's meant to be the sort of, you know, the hero, and he starts to grate in that film. But here, where, you know, he's the butt of some of the, where he's the butt of the gags a lot of the time, and he's actually making self-deprecating remarks about himself, the humor's at the expense of Belushi, I can get along with that in a way which, you know, when some of the performances he puts in other films, it's like, ooh, I really find this guy irritating.
Yeah, well, the other thing, too, I think, with Red Heat is that you had Schwarzenegger, who was kind of this larger-than-life figure, whereas here it was just Jim Belushi against the really good villains of, you know, Miguel Ferrer and Anthony Head, that you're kind of, with the self-deprecating part of it, you're rooting, or at least I was, you know, I was rooting for Belushi to pull this off and defeat these baddies. Whereas, yeah, in Red Heat, I think it's the problem sometimes when you have the buddy cop system, is that sometimes there's always going to be one who's a little bit better than the other, and or we root for more, where in this case we can only root for Belushi, but I think it worked enough that we could root for him.
Yeah, I mean, as you pointed out, that scene at the beginning really kind of sets the tone, where, you know, he hits on that woman, but you know, he gets closed down very, very quickly by her, and you know, kind of publicly humiliated. And you know, there's also part of that scene is we see him playing cards with this kid who is, you know, staying with his parents at the resort, and he's losing at cards to this child as well. And you know, the other joke that I quite enjoyed with throughout this film is he's consistently telling them that he's a secret agent, but they invariably don't believe him, which I felt factored into that sort of self-deprecating humor, which I think is a big part of this film. What do you think of the casting here of Jim Belushi in this role? I ask because in many ways he's one of the last people you'd expect to see as an international spy. You know, he's meant to be part of this black ops unit, no less. But, you know, in other ways, this character has been created with Belushi in mind. So, you know, how do you think, you know, how well does it work for you in this particular film?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. I think one of the problems maybe with the film itself is that it maybe doesn't do enough to flesh out this idea that we're talking about the James Bond, but not James Bond because he's so goofy and kind of all the things that James Bond does well, this guy does in a way that's completely, the opposite and completely goofy and doesn't work. It's almost like it wasn't fully fleshed out, and you wonder, like, you know, maybe if they did fully flesh it out, or maybe Belushi might not have been right for it. But in this sense, it's almost like, yeah, if you needed a name to underpin a film like this, he does kind of come in and do it. I mean, I think he's like the right combination of goofy and doughy, but at that time he wasn't quite at that level, so he could do some of the stunts a little bit, and he could play it off well, that, you know, when he's fighting somebody or whatever, holding a gun, shooting at somebody, that kind of thing. He could do it well enough that it was believable enough, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think this film highlights one thing about Belushi that we kind of skirted around a little bit, which is he's actually sort of incredibly versatile, because you think about his career, he's been in all sorts of stuff. He's been in flat-out comedies. You know, he's been in flat-out action movies. He's even been in an erotic thriller. I don't know if you've ever seen Traces of Red from the early 90s. I'm not sure what possessed anyone to want to put Belushi as the male lead in an erotic thriller, but, you know, that's what we got. And he's also done, like, straight-out drama. I mean, he's in Salvador with James Wood, Oliver Stone. You know, that's a great movie. And he's got a lot of strings to his bow. I think do we need to have some sort of reevaluation of the Belushi?
Right. Well, that was kind of what I was thinking too, because as you look at it, kind of, you know, the film industry, I think, just changes maybe post Titanic, where, you know, like we were talking about, like, he can get a role in an erotic thriller. You know, in the early 90s, it was early to mid 90s, there's this resurgence of independent films that were so big. It was almost like it kind of made the 90s like another, you know, 1970s or 1930s in terms of like a great decade for movies. And then I think it's Titanic. I mean, I don't know what really causes the industry to change, but it seems like Titanic was like, oh, we can make these big tent productions that gets everybody to come see it, instead of, you know, an erotic thriller with Belushi that gets so many people in there and so many rents at the video store, and then a comedy where Belushi is pretending to be Charles Grodin or whatever it was that, you know, Belushi did. And you see kind of post Titanic in that late 90s, early 2000s, where Belushi's kind of struggling to find things, because I think a lot of those roles dried up, and then it's like, okay, well, this sitcom comes calling. I mean, this is, you know, consistent work that I'll get. And he ended up, that show ended up going on for 8 years. And so it's like a weekly paycheck, where I think for an actor like him that, like, doesn't have like a real niche, that it's, he just kind of does everything to get on a sitcom. I mean, kind of the same thing with his co-star, Courtney Thorne Smith, who was on Melrose Place. I think the same thing, where she was having trouble finding roles, and then here comes the sitcom, and it's like, yeah, I'll take it, you know. But I think for us, for, you know, Belushi, we think of Belushi as that guy now, and then sometimes you have to think, you know, we forget to go back into the 90s and go, wow, no, he did a lot of different things.
So the question then I think I need to ask you, Matt, is actually, I mean, you know, I started this podcast by positioning Jim Belushi as the lesser of the Belushis. Is he actually superior to John Belushi?
Yeah, it's, you could make the case, right? Because, you know, John Belushi was like maybe one of the greatest. He's up there as one, maybe perhaps one of the greatest comedic actors of all time. That, you know, we never quite know. I mean, interesting. Anniversary came up here, I think, a day or two ago. The woman that was with John Belushi when he died, who was accused of, I think, involuntary or manslaughter or something like that, because she was the one that injected the speedball that killed him. It was like the anniversary of her being convicted and doing, she ended up doing 15 months in prison, I think, for that. So actually, this kind of, you know, Belushi came up in the news recently, but, you know, he, you know, because he was so big, and I mean, he was so good at that. It's like Jim Belushi doesn't have anything that he does that well. But yeah, could you imagine John Belushi? I mean, you could maybe see him in a Royce. I think that's possible. I don't know if he could have done the action scenes as well as Jim did here. But yeah, you couldn't see John Belushi in an erotic thriller. I don't think you could see John Belushi in Gang Related, you know, or some of the other ones that we've talked about here. And I don't think John Belushi would have wanted to go anywhere near a 2000s family sitcom. So I don't know about that either. So the case could be made. I think it's a question of what's your definition of it, or maybe there are two different definitions of great.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the cast here. We've already talked about Jim Belushi. As the main villain of the piece, we've got Miguel Ferrer, who I thought is fantastic in this. He's one of those bad guys who clearly enjoys being a villain. He enjoys inflicting kind of some, elaborate revenge on people who have wronged him. And, he's got that wonderful voice, which, just sounds like a large brandy and a fine cigar. He really entertained me in this film. Did he work for you? Who else caught your eye in this movie in terms of the cast?
Yeah, I mean, Miguel Ferrer is always one of my favorites, and when I saw that he was cast in this, I was excited to see, what he did, and yeah, he definitely didn't disappoint. And, you can almost make the same case for him that he had almost a similar career in the 90s that Belushi had, but then when the 2000s comes, he gets on like a drama here in America, a crime drama, Crossing Jordan, and... I think also probably, like you said, like the voice, the look that he has, that like it's impossible for him to get into the Belushi category of treatment. But it's almost like their careers are almost the same. And in Miguel Ferrer's case, right, instead of it being a famous brother, it's a famous father that, yes, that he has. And so it is interesting how, like, if you've got a nice voice, a nice look to you, he's not going to become Jim Belushi. We don't think of him the way we think of Jim Belushi. And I mean, they're like almost the same age and everything. And he was the perfect baddie, I think, for this, because he also, it seems like, because this is supposed to be a comedic action film, there is almost a tinge of comedy in some of the ways that he carried things as well.
And I thought I really enjoyed Anthony Head as well. Again, he I haven't seen him do too many bad guys, and he had a real sort of nasty, vicious streak, which kind of surprised me a little bit. I haven't seen that from him before as an actor, but I thought it was great for the part.
Yeah, kind of one funny thing, maybe because Miguel Ferrer is in this, that it brought me back to RoboCop, and there was almost like a Kurtwood Smith to his villain in this that I really enjoyed. Yeah, I'm a fan of Anthony Head as well. I know he's also done some Albert Piano films, and of course, we know him from Buffy, but he was a great baddie in here as well. It's kind of like the second to Miguel.
And let's sort of wrap up, I think, the sort of main review of the film, but just sort of checking in on the action that we get in this this film. The opening action sequence is pretty good. Then the film kind of hits a bit of a lull. I think the midsection could do with a bit of pepping up. I mean, there are a few explosions, but nothing terribly exciting. And then it all sort of kicks off for the big dramatic ending. But there's a lot of hardware here that is on screen, which you just sort of think they wouldn't be able to afford to do this in America, but you can kind of, the dollar goes a lot further in 1994 Hungary. So made the film feel a bit bigger than it might otherwise be.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And I think especially when you're talking about nuclear weapons and things like that, you gotta find a way to get to that scale of stealing nuclear weapons. And I agree with you there. I think, we had talked about the pacing a little bit. I mean, I know you joke on here about Chekhov's helicopter. We had Chekhov's ketchup packet in one scene when Belushi gets arrested. But it takes a little while for that payoff for him to actually use the ketchup packet to expedite his release from prison, because he's accused of killing his buddies and gets in jail. And in fact, I think the fact that he was in jail, it was almost like that was like he was in there a little bit too long, I think, for the film. And that also kind of slowed the film down, because there really wasn't a lot of action that was happening in that period where and then when he does escape, it's kind of a quick and easy thing that could have maybe been more of a chase. It's just like he just kind of runs off through some shrubbery or whatever and gets a cab to escape or whatever. So there were parts where it seemed like the middle there wasn't as much action as maybe you would need. I think, this film did not follow the mindset that I always think about, maybe like the PM Entertainment model, or like when you think of a musical where there's a musical set piece every 10 to 15 minutes in the film. You know, an action film should be like that. It should have its own action set pieces every 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, just I'd just like to add my praise for the ketchup scene, because I thought that was quite a sort of clever little sort of sequence within the movie, and it's got that sort of, I guess, sort of MacGyver-esque improvisation of like, how am I going to get myself out of this particular situation? So I don't want to spoil it, but yeah, essentially he uses a ketchup sachet in order to effect his escape from this this prison bus. But I, you know, if there's more, if there'd been a few more touches like that within the film, a bit of sort of, you know, creativity around, I guess, the craft of espionage with Belushi, sort of, you know, getting himself out of situations by sort of using his wits, then I think that would have I think that would have made the film definitely stronger, for my money anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think we're used to spies that can, you know, that's part of being a spy, is that you kind of take in your surroundings and use it to get away. And you're right, it was almost like it was another part of the film that wasn't fully developed, that, you know, he kind of gives this sense when he does it, when he palms the ketchup packet or puts it in his sock, that like, this is a guy who's always doing this kind of thing, when really that wasn't the case.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, I think we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
Hi, everyone. This is Tim Costa.
I'm Hermano da Silva.
And this is Walter Vinci.
And together, we are the First Time Watchers Podcast.
Each week, we choose a movie to review that none of us has seen.
Watch it together.
And then discuss.
These movies could be new.
Or old.
Or on our list of shame.
You can find us on iTunes by searching for the First Time Watchers Podcast,
as well as on Stitcher.
And we love interacting with our listeners, so if you have any suggestions, send us a tweet,
an email,
or post to our Facebook page.
We'd love to hear from you.
That's right. I mean, it's all about interaction.
And talk about what we love, movies.
And you don't have to worry about us going on and on about this and that and the other. And oh,
no,
look,
no, no,
let's
no,
talk
stop,
about
stop,
this
stop,
minutiae
shut up,
here.
Shut up, shut up, shut
and
up, shut
up. And I wonder
shut
who
up,
the cat
God
I can
damn it, shut
I
up.
I think that's enough,
Walter.
My
God.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs at the end of the film as Belushi tries to thwart Ferrer's plan, which involves blowing up a train that they all now find themselves on. As Ferrer tries to make his escape from the train by leaping onto a ladder dangling from a helicopter hovering overhead, Belushi attaches an explosive to the unwitting Ferrer. Just as he's about to clamber into the helicopter, he realizes the explosive is attached to him. Unfortunately, it's too late. It explodes, blowing up the helicopter. So, Matt, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
I like the idea of it, but I think for me personally, I would have. So the thing I didn't like about the exploding helicopter action is that Anthony Head, you know, he's flying the helicopter and Ferrer's going up the ladder, and Anthony Head notices the explosive while he's kind of like not midway, but I guess better than halfway up, and then it's like Ferrer explodes, and then the explosion, I guess, drifts up and blows up the helicopter as well. I would have preferred more like a, you know, Ferrer gets into the helicopter, they're kind of smiling, like, hey, we made it, and all that stuff, and then all of a sudden they look and they see this, you know, they hear something, what was that? What's that beeping? Oh, no! And then they, you know, kind of, they look at each other, their eyes get big, and then we see the explosion. That's just my own personal take on it. I think that would have been a better execution for me.
Oh, no, I think that absolutely would have been a better execution, like 100%, because I don't know, also, you know, just on a practical level, I don't know how Anthony Head actually spots that explosive, but there were a couple of points that I wanted to highlight about this particular exploding helicopter, because Matt, I don't know if you noticed anything interesting or unique about the helicopter that blows up in this particular sequence.
No, I mean it's the green one, right? It's the green military one that
it
or
is.
Was it the oh, yeah?
So it's a Kamov Ka-26, and you'd obviously you're not a connoisseur of exploding helicopters like myself, but if you have another look at it, you'll notice that it's a very unusual helicopter, because it actually is what they call a coaxial helicopter. So it has two rotor blades, basically sort of layered one on top of the other. So as opposed to, say, like a Chinook, which has one helicopter, one rotor blade at the front and another one at the back. So it's basically got two rotor blades directly on top of each other. Now, that's a very that's called a coaxial helicopter. It's a very unusual design. It does have some advantages over a single rotor-bladed helicopter, in the sense that it is more stable in flight, because you don't need the tail rotor in order to kind of counteract the torque of the main rotor, and it also has kind of superior lift capabilities. But having these two rotor blades on one on top of the other, mechanically very challenging, and that's why you don't see more of these types of aircraft. But as I say, unusual helicopter, and this is the first time that and the only time in nearly sort of 500 helicopters that I've seen explode in movies, this is the only helicopter with a coaxial design that I've seen explode. So you've seen something unique here, Matt.
Wow, so this is interesting. I didn't realize that. I didn't catch that part of it. I think maybe because there was two different helicopters, and I think I was having trouble keeping them both straight, but I completely missed that. But that's interesting, because when we did Last of the Finest, I think that was the first time that a helicopter had been disabled and blew up due to sewage landing on the windscreen. Human waste, right? So this is the second. I guess this is the second time I've been here for a first.
Well, you know, I like to give you something interesting, you know, to all of my guests when they come on. So, you know, I think that was, you know, along with my initial enthusiasm for Royce, this, I think the fact that I'd seen a very unique helicopter exploded, that was one of the reasons why I was keen to do Royce. So, you know, I'm glad you can, you know, take away that sort of first for yourself and first in exploding helicopter history with you.
Yes, that was really exciting. One other thing I also noticed, and I don't know if this is something that you've noticed yourself, but in the very beginning of the film, when Belushi is escaping with the hostages, you know, and the helicopter is there, one of the things I noticed about that helicopter that I don't see a lot in action films is that the helicopter actually had an advantage by being above everybody on the ground and was using that advantage to actually take out people. You know, it was like, you know, bombing people and things like that. It seems like in most action films, it's actually a disadvantage to be in a helicopter and be above people, because, you know, pistols can take out helicopters, footballs can take out helicopters. It seems like being up in the air in the helicopter actually is a disadvantage in most action films. So that was something I actually appreciated about this.
You highlight a regular kind of beef that I have with helicopters in movies, is that they don't actually exploit enough the fact that they are above the action. So, you know, too often, you know, helicopter pilots in movies are flying too close to things that allow them to be, you know, swatted by a giant ape, or kind of they allow somebody to, I don't know, throw a rope around the landing skid, and that means they can get dragged down into trouble. So, you know, too often, you know, the pilots of these helicopters and movies are not taking advantage of the fact that they can be above, out of range of the action. So it's you know, it's good to see that you know, that the pilots here, they know, hey, we can you know, we're fine up here, we can stay out of trouble, and we can like bomb the heck out of all these people on the ground.
Yeah, and maybe that's, in this case, we almost have a little bit more of a touch of verisimilitude, and this is the fact that, you know, Anthony Head understands it, but he had to bring his helicopter down to get Miguel Ferrer on the ladder. But also, he was doing his job correctly. It was Ferrer who wasn't paying attention to, you know, and maybe that was too much verisimilitude, because I guess maybe they thought there wasn't enough timer on the bomb for Ferrer to get, you know, I guess they would have thought, like, oh, it took him, you know, it only said there was 30 seconds or 3 seconds or however many seconds left. There's no way he could have gotten back into the helicopter. We would have just poo-pooed the whole movie. So I guess that's why they had to blow him up on the ladder instead. But, you know, at least in that case, yeah, it wasn't like a helicopter was doing something, you know, and maybe because Anthony Head is a trained military helicopter pilot, whereas maybe sometimes in these cases it's an independent contractor who doesn't know enough on how to be a helicopter pilot in action scenarios.
Okay, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Matt, thank you for coming on the show again and helping me unravel the mystery of Jim Belushi. Do you want to take a moment to tell people where they can find you online?
Yeah, absolutely. Direct-to-Video Connoisseur is the blog. It's dtvconnoisseur.blogspot.com, and that's where you can find all the social. So I'm on Twitter at dtvconnoisseur, I think dtvc in, or dtvconnoisseur on Instagram, and also Direct-to-Video Connoisseur on Facebook. Also, my novel, Chad and Accounting, is available on Amazon for paperback and Kindle. Also, I just self-published a new novel, A Girl and a Gun. That is also available on Amazon and Kindle on Amazon. The thing is, I'm waiting for the author's copy, so I'm not really – I haven't been, like, out – you know, but I imagine when this podcast is published, it should be out by then.
Yeah, well, make sure you go and check out Matt's stuff. As always, don't forget to have a look at the Exploding Helicopter website, explodinghelicopter.com, for reviews of films where helicopters explode. If you can rate, review, or retweet us, then that'll help get the word out about what we're doing. We'll be back soon, but until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Why do you think you were the target?
Simple. Because this is my apartment. And because 10 out of 10 times when someone knocks on my door, I'm the one who answers it.
Not tonight.
It's registered.
What are you doing with the 38, Mr. Royce?
I'm a secret agent.
Funny. Anybody in particular trying to kill you? Mr. Goldfinger, maybe.